From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and its radio affiliates. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In today's show...
Some of the landlords kick people out, you know, let some of the banks kick people out. All right, let's, rather than have it happening all at once where everybody gets evicted, let's kind of like slow it.
28 million Americans are facing eviction or foreclosure as moratoriums on both expire at the federal, state, and municipal level.
I think maybe after yesterday's visit, officials realized that we're really upset and we really need answers.
Protests to demand justice for Breonna Taylor and an end to police impunity continue in Louisville, Kentucky.
And everyone was thinking that the respiratory centers of the brainstem might be involved by COVID. And we didn't see any inflammation in the respiratory centers of the brain. So,
surprising discoveries regarding COVID-19, Pacifica Radio speaks to pathologist Dr. Mary E. Folks at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. This and more on today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. Now, as eviction and foreclosure moratoriums expire, many tenants face not only loss of their homes, but also harassment by landlords. Sarah Blanco reports from Contra Costa County, California.
We turn our attention to California, specifically a city in Contra Costa, where a renter has been feeling harassed by her landlord since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, even though she says that she has informed him from the beginning that she wasn't going to be able to pay due to COVID-19. She has chosen to remain anonymous. We will call her Yannette. Yannette is self-employed and her work is cleaning houses. The city she lives in and the county have an eviction moratorium until September 2020. While there are requirements she has as a tenant to document her income losses and to notify the landlord in time if she can't pay rent, she feels she has been doing so. The following audio documentary recordings we will hear came from Yannette directly and are being used with her permission. They highlight not only the struggle that her and her daughter face as renters affected by the pandemic, but also show their struggle and courage to make sure they exert their right to protect themselves in their own home. One of the times that the landlord arrived to her home, Yannette and her 12-year-old child called 911, and they recorded themselves doing so. These are short excerpts of the call.
911, where's your emergency?
I want to file a report.
What are you reporting?
Abuse, vocally. Because he's the landlord of the apartments and we feel like he's going to come at any moment because he's done that before and we feel like he's going to do that again. I am 12 and he was talking to me in a way that I really didn't like. He was cussing and he was telling me to shut up and I told him to stop and he was like, I don't care who you are in this. And now I don't feel safe sleeping here because I am scared he's going to come and like do something to us, to me and my mom. I don't feel safe. He comes whenever he wants sometimes. Like, let's say an hour ago, he came and he banged on the window. He was banging, and my mom was taking a shower, and I was in the room. And, like, that's what makes me really unsafe because he was banging and banging on the door and on the window and on the walls and, like, looking through our window room. And it's made me feel real unsafe, and I feel like he's going to do that while we're sleeping, and I really don't want him to do that.
At the end of this 911 call, the operator does take down their phone numbers and lets them know that an officer will be calling them. The following audio is from a video taken when two people came to their door on behalf of the landlord. The tenant, Yannette, thinks that they may be the landlord's sons. They stand at the door and ask her for more documentation of loss of income, which she says she has sent already by email, and they tell her that it isn't enough.
Those documents don't really state that you're not getting a loss in. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know what? You know what? I'll figure out now this. I text you and I tell you, I'll let you know when I'm ready. So I'm not ready yet.
But you can't really state you're not ready if you're still getting paid because you're an essential worker.
Okay, but this is like enough. I don't know why you come, like, whatever you guys want. So this is not good.
Well, it's not that whatever okay, we well, want. I mean, we need the money.
Yeah,
the
I know. Rent. I understand that.
So
and I understand. So I got your phone call. I text you back and you never answer. So
you just sent a text. You didn't call back.
And I text like you times. Back. When you guys don't want to answer my text, you guys don't do it. So.
Well, I mean, if
you, okay, you know what? I'm not going to talk to you guys today. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
But, I mean, you need to show us proper payment. I mean,
in a letter dated April 6, 2020, Yannette's landlord sent a 24-hour notice of intent to enter premises for the next day between noon and 4 p.m. The reason given on the notice is simply inspect the premises. We hear the landlord upon entry to their home in this next clip. The landlord is holding his phone out like he either is recording or is appearing to be taking video. The tenants were taking their own video, and here are some of the sounds as he wanders their home.
To inspect that unit? Yeah.
Why do you want to inspect? I don't understand why you are here all the time. You can whatever you want. That's
yeah,
not
you,
nice.
You banged on the door last time. You think that didn't scare us? You were banging on the window.
In the
you think that's okay?
Windows, door. That's not nice.
And you were cussing at her, and we recorded it.
Okay, we haven't called. That's fine. That's fine.
Go check. There's no one living here.
We don't get it. Why are you guys always here?
While Yannette and her 12-year-old daughter have been brave with sharing this audio, and they've been courageous with wanting to share their story to help others, it's important to note that the emotional trauma that they are experiencing has taken a very serious toll on them, including loss of sleep and feeling unsafe in their own home. We want to make sure that Yannette and her daughter know we're grateful they shared their story. Thank you to you both. Since this story is from Contra Costa, California, we decided to talk to Delia Pedrosa, local fair housing advocate, as to what people can do if they feel they're being harassed by their landlord.
Sometimes you have to call, for example, the outreach, the 211. They have a tremendous list of resources where they can provide them with, you know, the best ones for the tenant to call and get help right away. The key here is to call. Call and reach out to any resources to get to the right agency. If this continues on, you know, as far as any harassment happening by their landlords, the best thing that they can do is right away call the police, because the shelter in place legal order, there is a recital there that the sheriffs will enforce the shelter in place and law enforcement. So they can call one or the other. And once they connect to someone that can help them, maybe, you know, help them get a restraining order together.
Delia also noted that she sees that the state is already preparing for what could possibly be a flood of evictions and unlawful detainers. We want to thank Delia and all others who are working to help renters in this time of crisis. As listeners, we all can do our part by making sure we understand what's happening. And then if we got a little bit extra in us, find out what's happening in our local communities and report. For Pacifica Radio, this has been Sarah Blanco. Special thanks to producer Free Willen Franklin.
Nick Brenna, founder and national director of the Movement for a People's Party, on the Jimmy Dore Show, said this about the looming eviction crisis.
You know what's probably going to happen, Jimmy?
What?
Is they're going to put the moratorium back because I think they're sufficiently afraid of a revolution if they kick one out of every 10 Americans into the streets when there's already been an uprising against, you know, police brutality and systemic racism. And there's an ongoing, like, civil war in Portland. You know, I think that they're going to reestablish it. And I think their strategy is essentially what they are so good at doing, which is kick the can down the road. You know, start diminishing the unemployment benefits. You know, that's what the talk is. Of course, make the stimulus payment a check, like make that a one-time thing, not recurring. God forbid recurring. 82% of Americans want recurring, but f*** them, you know. And then also they're going to basically have this, they're going to renew the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, but after a gap period. you know, to let some of the landlords kick people out, you know, let some of the banks kick people out. All right, let's rather than have it happening all at once where everybody gets evicted, let's kind of like slow it, you know, so that it doesn't, you know, so that you don't have this like moment where everybody finds themselves out of their house like immediately. You know, let's make it kind of progressively happen. You know how we got the New Deal, Jimmy, in the 1930s?
I do, go ahead.
You know, yeah, what happened in the 1930s, there was, in response to the Depression, you know, which is like the closest analog to what we have today, you know what it took to get the New Deal? Franklin Roosevelt, he was a fiscal conservative, you know, before he became office. And then he took action to save capitalism when he actually became sufficiently afraid that there was going to be a Bolshevik revolution. And the business elite in the country became sufficiently afraid of that. You know what else they tried to do? They actually tried to overthrow him. There was a plot to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 by major industrialists. They tried to recruit Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine war veteran, you know, who'd been like regime changing Latin America for them for decades. They tried to recruit this guy. Unfortunately for them, they, you know, he had like a change of heart on what he had done all these years. And he, you know, he had written a book. He was very influential with the Bonus Army. And he said, you know, and he refused. He refused, and he outed them. And there were congressional hearings about it for years, about there was a fascist coup to throw off the elected government in this country, you know, and nothing happened. No one was ever prosecuted for it. You know what else happened that made this change? There was the Bonus Army. This was tens of thousands of veterans who hadn't been paid for World War I. They occupied Washington, D.C. for weeks. Several weeks in Anacostia, in other buildings, and then until the federal government evicted them with tanks and burned down their shanty town that they had created. And you know what the other things that happened is there were independent parties that came about. They started pressuring the Democratic Party from the left.
From the left. There was actual socialist parties. There was actual communist parties. There was that were viable, and they pressured, and that's how it happened. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. They broke the monopoly that the Democratic and the Republican parties had over voters, because guess what? Progressives are so good at understanding the logic of monopolies when it comes to a business or economics, but they don't get it when it comes to politics. You know, it's the same principle. If you have to vote for one of two parties, which are basically the same party, then you don't have a choice and you have no leverage, and they can do the kinds of things that you do now.
That was Nick Brana on The Jimmy Dore Show. You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a special broadcast by Pacifica Radio. I'm Ann Garrison. As Trump dispatched his goons to quell protest, and he now says stop gang violence, in cities across the U.S., I spoke to civil rights, policing, and privacy expert Tracy Rosenberg.
Well, certainly, first and foremost, it's a political stunt to capture the law and order crowd, then divide coastal cities and heartland voters. But if the use of federal forces is designed to weaken local accountability by freezing out local governments that are easier for constituents to reach and to vote out of office. Portland's mayor wasn't asked. In other words, it wasn't mutual aid of any sort. This was an invasion.
At first, Trump was just sending federal forces in to quell demonstrations, but now he's announced that he's sending more, including ATF and DEA agents, to fight crime and particularly gang violence in cities run, again, by liberal Democratic mayors. They include Kansas City, Chicago, Baltimore, Milwaukee, Albuquerque, and Oakland, all cities with large populations of people of color. Baltimore is majority Black. Albuquerque is at least 47% Hispanic or Latinx. What do you think of this development?
Well, first of all, it's a pretty classical example of what we call commission creep, which is when you expand the original reason or purpose or jurisdiction of doing something into something else entirely. The reason, supposedly, that federal troops were dispatched was to protect federal property, buildings, courthouses, etc. And now we have an expansion into the kind of drug crimes primarily that ATF and DEA act on. And so we're sort of muddling up the counterterrorism response to protests and Antifa with the ongoing racial profiling that's involved with so-called war on gangs or war on drugs, which are almost entirely federal operations that are carried out in majority black and brown neighborhoods.
Who are these federal goons? What branch of the enforcement apparatus are they drawn from, in addition to the ATF and DEA agents that Trump says he's dispatching to fight crime?
Well, it's really been an alphabet soup of federal agencies. Some of the ones that we know about include the National Guard, the U.S. Marshals, and the Secret Service. But the highly publicized Portland's kidnappings or detentions of protesters, depending what you want to call it, were carried out by the Customs and Border Patrol, specifically Border Patrol Tactical Squad, which is called BORTAC, B-O-R-T-A-C. And Trump has recently tweeted that he also intends to mobilize the Homeland Security Investigation Division of ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
And what's their legal authority, if any, if they have any? What gives them the right to drive around in unmarked cars, dressed and armed like paratroopers, without badges or anything else identifying them or the agency they represent? What gives them the right to snatch people off the streets and then hold them without charge?
Well, that, of course, is the big question. Legal authority, such as it is, would derive from two sources. Firstly, the organizational mission and the jurisdiction of the agency, and secondly, the Constitution and the power that it provides to the executive branch. So when you look at the mission of some of these agencies, the mission of the U.S. Marshals is to protect the judiciary and to pursue fugitives. The mission of the Secret Service is to defend the president and his and her family from personal harm. The mission of the Border Patrol is to police the international borders, both land and air. So where we're going here is that chasing protesters around cities in response to graffiti on federal buildings is not the mission of any of these agencies or any of these federal officers. Trump is claiming that in a state of emergency that he has called, he can redefine the mission of these agencies as he pleases. But that is a highly questionable proclamation on his part. When it comes to the Constitution itself, the right to petition the government, also known as protest, is an absolute right of the people. When that gets blurred is when you have, you know, some low-grade criminal activity involved, like vandalism or trespassing. But even when those things are happening, or even more serious kinds of property damage or physical violence, the due process protections in the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments don't magically disappear. So in short, the answer to the question is unidentified personnel cannot simply snatch people off the street and take them into custody without a charge.
Can cities and states assert authority over them?
Well, what we call states' rights or federalism has a long history in American jurisprudence, and it's largely upheld in the courts. The intention of the Third Amendment, when the Bill of Rights was written, was to prevent the federal government, which was new at that time, from attacking the states with military personnel. That's still standing law, but it largely relates to states, not cities. So we would need the governors to kind of step up here and say, get out of my state. And some of them have started.
Is the same true of states' authority over the forces Trump's now sending to, he says, fight violent crime?
Yeah, that's a more complicated kind of question. But again, you kind of have to get back to mission creep, which is when you dispatch federal troops, you do it with an assignment. And the assignment here was to protect federal property. And when you endlessly expand it into these other areas, you basically outrun the legal authority that you're claiming. There is a bit of a hedge in the Constitution, which sort of responds to federal authority in times of peace. But then the question is Trump pursuing some kind of an undeclared war against Democratic-led cities or Black Lives Matter or Antifa or kind of all three? Because if he's jumping outside the in times of peace language, then he is saying that he is in a time of war. And most of the rest of us have not recognized that.
Okay, the ACLU and other rights groups in Portland and Chicago have sued Trump to stop the crackdowns on protests. What do you think their chances of success are, especially given the way Trump has packed the federal courts?
Well, that's a concern, of course, but they did get a 14-day restraining order in Portland. So they've started off in a positive way. Chances on the West Coast are pretty good. The Ninth Circuit remains the most reliably liberal circuit court in the country, and they've rebuked Trump over and over again. In other circuit courts, maybe the outcome is less certain, but again, states' rights is a long-standing legal precedent. Of course, the circuits are not the final level of the courts, and who knows what the Supreme Court would do if it's presented with an emergency request to overrule. But again, the courts are slow, and we are potentially experiencing a change in president in 3.5 months. So I expect the intent here is really messaging. Trump is becoming the protector of ordinary white Americans against their enemies, domestic and foreign, and the race traitors who side with them.
More and more prominent leaders and activists articulate demands well beyond the end of police brutality, including the abolition of prisons and the end of U.S. wars. We seem to be seeing a national revolt against what's come to be known as the carceral state, even though academics, lawyers, and social critics are still trying to define it. Is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, I think that what we've seen develop is a broad understanding outside of the usual left-wing circles and academia that there is a carceral state, that policing is flawed and possibly unsalvageable. That's not a fringe idea as much as it has been. And that is one thing that social media and cell phones have accomplished. A picture can be worth 1,000 words, and we now have 1,000 videos. Whether this has sort of translated into mainstream support for any particular policy agenda, I'm not so sure. But the first step is always, oh my God, we have to do something. And we seem to have moved in a broad sense into that first stage.
Tracy Rosenberg, Executive Director of Media Alliance and Coordinator of Oakland Privacy. Davey D. of KPFA's Hard Knock Radio spoke to Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., President and Chairman of the Prisoners of Conscience Committee.
These federal troops coming into Chicago, what we saw in Portland was them coming at activists. Can you talk about the attack of activists in your city right now and if you feel those federal troops will enhance it? I know that yourself, you just put a video up with them kind of putting fences around your home. So these attacks are going on with and without federal troops. Also, while we saw this, we saw the video of heavily armed police beating protesters, knocking out the teeth of a black girl who was protesting Columbus. So this is happening all within the last week without federal troops.
Yeah. Yes. So you're going to see these situations on steroids. Similar to, as we say, what's been happening in our community is already one dynamic with the climate of coronavirus is capitalism on steroids. And under the auspices of war on gangs, war on drugs, there has always been an attack on the black community in particular, and also more intensified attack on those who resist. We've seen it, the Democratic Convention 1968. Under the auspices, stopping riots, so on and so forth. We've seen the oppression come down, doors kicked in through the Henry Horton Home Projects on the west side of Chicago, people being murdered. We've seen the intensified gentrification, what we refer to as the land grab, displacing the people. There are so many long-range effects that we are to see. Again, from these different attacks, the tagging of giving individuals cases is going to affect their records, in the future. And again, we see when different organizations, even with the street organizations, which hits an emotion, that opens the door for the state to move, to come through, make its moves, And not that it's done under justification of war on crime, so on and so forth, war on gangs, so on and so forth. It's kind of something like there are some of the people who come up murdered, who the state is murdered, and it's been dismissed as just coronavirus, COVID-19. So this is a climate where, you know, saying, where the state is able to intensify, you know, saying, its attacks, you know, saying, that has historically been going down, again, on the black community in particular, and other every other colonized community, but also in particular those individuals when you see make a progressive move, engage in some sort of fight for social justice, or just even acknowledging that there's a war being waged on us. We've seen that attack become intensified.
What should we do moving forward at this point, Chairman Fred?
I think that it's imperative, as we always say, you know, like even I'm going to borrow the mantra from Alcoholics Anonymous, when they say the first step in addressing the problem is recognizing we have a problem. We're in a stage right now where it's terrible, but it's fine. We're in a stage right now where politically the emperor has no clothes on. There, we've seen it can be correlated to that climate we've seen under the tenure of Richard Milhouse Nixon, where if you try to duck and dodge this question, what's going on? There's a blatancy of statement. And these are reactionary times. We must seize the time. We must seize the time. To move forward. They be revolutionary times. Because again, we come off the heels of an era that was a class piece where people were trying to use terms like post-racial society. Let's acknowledge the race. Let's acknowledge the class contradiction. Let's meet it head on. Let's acknowledge the dynamic of the role the state plays in our community. Let's be very clear. And not just people have to wait till it hits their front door. And it is. It's a stage of the game that is hit. The covers of being pulled off. You can't the press statements alone, the press conference alone from Donald Trump, the straight up blatancy about what's going on, and you hear political terms being referenced in regards to the colonized community. We have to get to the stage of acknowledging people that we have political prisoners. We have to get to the stage of recognizing that there are propaganda bombs being dropped on our community. And with that being said, in return, we must recognize that we must politically resist.
That was Fred Hampton Jr. speaking to Davey D. of Hard Knock Radio in an interview first aired on KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley. Next on COVID, Race, and Democracy, it's been over 4 months since 26-year-old black emergency room tech Breonna Taylor was gunned down by police in her home in Louisville, Kentucky, in a middle-of-the-night raid. Community members are frustrated over the lack of accountability for this murder, among other grievances. Protests have not ceased in Louisville, and Saturday, July 25th, was a particularly tense day when the Not Effing Around Coalition joined the protests to demand justice for Breonna Taylor and an end to police impunity. A militia calling itself the Kentucky 3% Security Force were also present to counter-protest. Grandmaster Jay, the leader of NFAC, spoke to a crowd of protesters in Louisville on Saturday, July 25th.
So when they want to make money, they don't give a damn who's in the way. They call it gentrification. Yes, we call it colonization. Yes, they dissolve your neighborhood. They take money out of it so that it's crime and poverty, which breeds crime. Then they over-police you and blame you for your own situation. And then they act like they're doing you a favor by coming in and incarcerating you or killing you.
I give you a help.
Tia Coatley at Pacifica Radio affiliate WXOX 97.1 FM in Louisville talked on Sunday with producer Hamid Khan of KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
What is the current status of Breonna Taylor's murder investigation by law enforcement? And if you could just give us a quick snapshot of what the official version is, and then how is the community, what is the community's version?
So as far as the technicalities of the case, there's a lot that is still unknown. But what we do know is that the mayor announced that he recently provided our Attorney General Daniel Cameron with information to further investigate the case. Now, we all know this happened back in March, and there's been an uproar in regards to the case for the last several months. However, our mayor has just announced that he's just provided the AG with more information to allow for further investigation. Now, from the community standpoint and from the experiences yesterday with the NFC being in town, we learned that we're being asked to give them 4 more weeks to look deeper into the case, and that we should have more information within that time frame.
I want you to look at your watch. Check the date and look at 4 weeks from now. And if the powers to be don't come before you and announce arrest, now we caught them in a lie.
Yeah. So, and how is the, what do you feel is the community's response to these delays and this back and forth and, you know, all those new developments every few couple of days and all of that?
Well, understandably, it's, you know, outrage, because we all feel like we're being distracted by a multitude of things. A lot of folks feel like there's not even going to be any charges brought up against the officers, which is why the consistent distractions are happening. This is really the first time we've been able to get anything concrete. I think the fear of the NFAC being in a city really meant something to officials here in Louisville, because we actually got that answer that it would be 4 weeks. We actually got a public apology from the mayor. And so, I mean, it's, people are upset. You know, there's been a lot of corruption here in the city and a lot of police misconduct. And much more often than not, these things are brushed under the rug, dismissed, and allowed to continue. And the people are upset. The people are very upset about just the way our officials are handling this situation. But hopefully, I think maybe after yesterday's visit, officials realize that we're really upset and we really need answers.
This ain't slavery no more. This ain't Reconstruction no more. This is not even the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, or the teens. God damn it, this 2020, and we got perfect f***ing vision.
Hell yeah!
So what happened yesterday?
So, as expected, the NFAC came into Louisville to make their demands.
So the NFAC is asking the people of Louisville, we're going to give them 4 weeks from today.
And to offer militia support to the protesters, to those of us who have been out here fighting for you know, fighting for justice for Breonna Taylor.
In the case of Ms. Taylor, we got law enforcement that lied about getting a warrant.
There was a lot of fear projected on us prior to their arrival, that they might come into the city and burn it down, that they might come into the city and just become the Wild Wild West. And in all actuality, I mean, we saw them at Stonewall. That's not what they do. And so we were excited about their presence. Some of us were excited about their presence. And they came in, they made their demands as they said they would. And they actually provided us with more answers. Now, additionally, there were some 3 percenters that showed up with the thought that they were coming to cause trouble. And as it turns out, they didn't. And there were a few people who showed up in opposition of their presence, but no trouble. I mean, I almost want to say they were kind of in and out. The most disturbing aspect of their presence was when they left and how aggressive the LMPD became with protesters after the group left. And I think that should be investigated.
Hearing Grandmaster Jay speak on that video that was making the rounds on Facebook, he was saying that how they had already, you know, spoken to the authorities, and in essence they were the ones who were providing direction and control in a sense to law enforcement as well. What do you make of that?
You know, confusion, like a lot of us. You know, it's like, are you with us? Are you against us? And I don't know if that's a tactic or not. I watched on several live videos as well yesterday, and during previous demonstrations, you would see police officers walk up talking to protesters, shaking hands, praying with the protesters, singing together, electric sliding up and down Jefferson Street. And within the hour, they were chasing them and slamming them to the ground and arresting them and all the worst things you can imagine. So a lot of confusion. You know, what are we doing here? You know, are you with us? Are you against us? What's going on? I mean, I know that not all cops are bad. And so maybe they're sending the good cops to come in and pray and electric slide with folks and meet the NFAC and make sure that they get here safely. Maybe that's the case. But what I do know is that there's been a lot of perceived love and care and acceptance of our protesting, what we're fighting for. And then it changes within an instant. Like I said, you know, I also was there and I heard Grandmaster Jay speak about the police working with them and everything seemingly okay.
I talked to your attorney general. I talked to your mayor's office. I talked to the police department. I talked to all the activist groups out here. I talked to the usual suspects like the NAACP and all these other groups that keep collecting money, but it don't change.
But then I also saw how the police reacted to protesters as soon as the NFAC left. So it's a lot of confusion. So today, people are still on edge. Last night, the LMPD ran up on some protesters at the Big Four Bridge here. About 30 protesters out at the walking bridge doing their usual chanting, justice for Breonna Taylor. And out of nowhere, dozens of cops swooped in. They pulled guns on the protesters. And just like there were protesters out there, there were a bunch of regular people walking around trying to enjoy the sights of the city, and everybody was in fear for their life because police officers were out pulling guns on people and being very aggressive again, simply because people were, exercising their right to assemble. Mm-hmm. And so things are continuing here, and they're violent and they're aggressive, and it's hard to carry on about your day knowing that type of aggression surrounds you no matter what you do. And a man was pulled over last night and locked up by a police officer simply for riding his bike in the wrong place, wrong time. I mean, it's, you're on edge. You don't know. It could be you out at Thornton's and run across the wrong officer and you end up the next news story. It's so unnerving. And that is the energy around here right now for the majority of the people in Louisville, Kentucky.
That was Tia Coatley from Pacifica affiliate WXOX 97.1 FM in Louisville, speaking with producer Hamid Khan of KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break.
the painter casting shadows on the water as the sun plays on the infantry returning from the sea. The doer and the thinker, no allowance for the other, as the failing light illuminates the mercenary's creed. The home fire burning, the kettle almost boiling, but the master of the house is far away. The horse is champing, their warm breath clouding in the sharp and frosty morning of the day. And the boy lifts his head while the soldier sits his guard. And the youngest from the family is moving with the party, building castles by the sea. He dares a tiny time to watch them all aside.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Scientists continue to look for answers about how COVID-19 works. Dr. Mary E. Folks has been conducting autopsies on COVID patients. Dr. Folks is Associate Professor of Pathology and Attending Pathologist with Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. She shares some very surprising discoveries with Pacifica producers Lona Elias of WPFW, Washington, D.C., and Akua Holt of KPFT, Houston.
From the autopsies performed at Mount Sinai, what were the most surprising discoveries?
Oh, the strokes, for sure. The number of strokes and the fact that there are small micro infarcts, small, tiny little microscopic strokes that are scattered in different spots throughout the brain, that the usually if you have a stroke, you have a blood clot that occludes one blood vessel and you have an area that has a stroke. But to have multiple strokes in multiple different areas throughout the brain, that is unusual. There's part of the brainstem is responsible for respiratory control. And everyone was thinking that the respiratory centers of the brainstem might be involved by COVID. And we didn't see any inflammation in the respiratory centers of the brain. So we're still sampling regions to get a better handle on where this virus is, how it's causing the damage. But identifying it in the lymph nodes, identifying it in the spleen, finding thrombi in the liver, that was unexpected, totally unexpected. And we had a group of pathologists all come together to discuss what we were finding so that we could try and figure it out.
Will these findings impact protocols? And if so, how will these findings affect treatments going forward?
They already have changed some of the protocols going forward and patients right in the beginning because we had to, the clinicians had to do COAG studies. So looking at whether or not the person is developing blood clots abnormally. So if there's treatments for somebody that is developing too many blood clots, so you can give anticoagulants. So if you're developing a blood clot, anticoagulants will make it so you're less likely to develop a blood clot. So that has already been implemented on COVID cases. Because we're finding, although there's lung problems, if you treat some of the symptoms early, if you have antibiotics on board, if you have anticoagulants on board, if you give oxygen early, then the lung issues can start resolving a little bit earlier. And so then you're less at risk of having to be intubated. A lot of the patients that intubated did die, but not everyone that was intubated. We had a large proportion of patients choose not to be intubated. A lot of the patients that were intubated did not die. And I think that it's important for people to know that if you have COVID, even if you're older, maybe being intubated is not such a bad thing. You get intubated, get the support so that you can survive the initial infection and then get better. And I think that's important. A lot of people, as you get older, don't want to be intubated. But with this disease, intubation may be important. I was very surprised that it's not just older people that are dying. We have a substantial number of patients in their 30s and 40s that have died from COVID. Most of the people that died are in their 60s and 70s. And then there's a smaller number, similar to 30s and 40s, that are in their 70s and 80s and a few in their 90s. But we do have deaths in their 20s and 30s. And we don't know which patients are going to be most susceptible to die. However, if a person has heart disease, hypertension, atherosclerosis, diabetes, obesity, we know they're going to be more at risk. Now, obviously, if they have lung disease, they also may be at risk. But the greatest risk is associated with hypertension, atherosclerosis, heart disease, obesity, and diabetes.
Dr. Folks, recently it's been reported in Corpus Christi, 85 babies under the age of one have tested positive for COVID. Can you help us understand why children so young have been now all of a sudden contracting this disease?
Well, I think that just the spread of the virus itself probably is making it so that we're recognizing that these children are coming down with the virus. Part of the problem in the beginning was we couldn't test. When New York City got hit by the virus, we were only testing patients that were needed to be hospitalized. If you had symptoms and you weren't having breathing problems, you simply were not tested. So I think now that we're having the ability to test more, we didn't have enough swabs to do the nasal testing to look for the virus. So it's possible that some people had the virus and we were not aware of it. But if the virus is going through the population and infecting everyone and it has a high viral load with high viral particles being spread in the environment, certainly children are still going to be at risk for coming down with the virus.
There's been a debate about masks online. Some people say that you need an N95 to keep the microbes out. Some say that wearing just a cloth mask will allow the microbes to enter because of the way they're woven. What say you on this mask debate?
Presumably the best mask, the most effective mask is two portions of cotton material with a synthetic, like a nylon, even like a stocking, between the two cotton sections of cloth. Obviously, the cloth, if it's tightly woven cloth, it's going to be a little bit more effective. But those three layers together are very effective and close to the effectiveness of an N95. Not quite as good, but very close. I think any mask, even one layer of cotton, is still going to prohibit the large particles from escaping your mouth area and traveling to your neighbor. And I know how effective wearing a mask can be because I work in New York City and I've unfortunately witnessed too many COVID deaths and done too many autopsies. And the best way to prevent that is wear a mask.
That was Dr. Mary E. Folks, Associate Professor of Pathology and Attending Pathologist with Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, in conversation with Pacifica producers Lona Elias of WPFW Washington, D.C., and Akua Holt of KPFT Houston.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
A concert for Cuba took place in a virtual space on July 18 and 19 to celebrate the work of Cuban medics responding to the coronavirus pandemic. It brought together supporters of normalization of relations between Cuba and the U.S. from around the globe. Here's a taste of what took place during the virtual concert offered free of charge by hothouse.net.
Con ese amor, hacer de mi vida bálsamo ideal, que cure mi herida para así vivir toda una eternidad.
From the U.S. blockade, we, for too long, have been deprived of all that Cuba has to offer. Luckily, tonight we are able to both celebrate the generosity of Cuban spirit on worldwide display this spring and enjoy the music and song of a people whose culture is a celebration of life itself.
Unfortunately, this direction toward a reasonable policy towards Cuba reversed with this administration, and relations are at an all-time low, imposing many hardships to the people who live on the island.
Oh, we so applaud you, the Cuban people, as you negotiate your internal destinies of how you want to live, what values you want to uphold, but your readiness to share with the entire world as you're sharing your medical brigade contributions in the interest of all of humanity. We are fighting on this front to remove this economic warfare against you called the blockade.
Just recently, I joined a number of activists in the United States and around the world in a campaign to nominate the heroic Cuban Medical Brigade for the Nobel Peace Prize.
It's a lot of passion and appreciation for all that Cuba has represented for the world.
Absolutely. Most definitely. So we want to just tell everybody, in this program, there were over 100 people that participated just performing on camera.
Let's enjoy the music. Let's be grateful that we're all alive. And let's not forget our duty to our fellow citizens of this planet to be there for them in times of need. I thank the Cuban doctors and nurses and others who've done that. And perhaps someday you could come here and help us.
Oh, your funny ways to subjugate the truth. In the end, it will turn up against itself. If you blocked everyone, you're just blocking yourself. And thus you're buying a ticket to loneliness. These people keep waking up with dignity.
And we'll close with the words of Black Agenda Report editor Margaret Kimberly.
We cannot be confused. Remember that when the U.S. speaks of human rights, you are hearing from the country that has more of its population incarcerated, some 2 million people, than any other country in the world. Military spending larger than that of the next 10 countries combined. It allows police to kill 1,000 people every year.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates for contributing to this and other editions of the show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev. I'm Ann Garrison. You can find all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.